Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How will the next president ensure national security? And is it possible to protect U.S. citizens from both international threats and the burdens of unchecked defense spending? My guest today would argue it is possible, but only with a commander-in-chief who is willing to challenge current assumptions about what it takes to safeguard U.S. interests. Gordon Adams is professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. His essay in the current Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda, How to Confront the Defense Budget Morass. You can find it online at thebulletin.org. Gordon, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You call the defense budget the most urgent challenge the next president will face. Why is that?
Well, the next president is going to face a really critical issue, I think, and that issue is going to be how is the United States going to engage the world in the future? Obviously, the next president coming in is going to have to deal with things like Iraq and Afghanistan and how to shift forces between them or set a deadline or bring forces home from Iraq and deal with the situation in Afghanistan. If that preoccupies the president's attention a lot, it's going to set him off track on what I think is the real challenge that he faces, which is the decline in the worldview of the United States and the decline in the receptivity the world has for American leadership. And a lot of that is going to involve for the president taking a look at a whole host of issues that confront the nation and a whole host of challenges with regard to the toolkit that he has to confront those issues. It's really, for me, a question of saying, how do we deal with problems of identity and globalization and governance and all the transnational issues that we face? And how do we do it with the full toolkit, not just the military, whom we've asked to do a lot, but with a strengthened diplomacy and a strengthened foreign assistance program, both of which have tended to be neglected in terms of the way in which we engage the world. So we're at a turning point, I would say, in the way that next administration is going to handle the world and the tools that the president is going to have at hand to do that.
Can you talk for a minute about how defense budgeting has been structured in the Bush administration?
Well, if it's been structured, we've been lucky. I mean, the reality is that on September 10th, 2001, Don Rumsfeld's job was in doubt because he was facing an impossibility. He had lost the confidence of the officer corps inside the Pentagon, and he wasn't going to be able to increase the budget for defense. And he was going to face some very difficult choices between the next generation of technology and expanding the force and dealing with all of the demands of the current force. September 11th, that all got blown away, and for the last 7 or 8 budget years, the Defense Department has really been in days of wine and glory in budgetary terms. Almost any resource that they needed, they've gotten. We're now spending roughly $700 billion a year on defense. It's more than double since the time that the administration first came into office, and in a way, defense has been able to have its cake and eat it too, thanks to supplemental budgets that are voted by the Congress to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and even some of the stuff that's in the basic defense plan. The Defense Department has had ample resources and has not had to face the serious choices that it was going to face once the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are over and the Congress is no longer willing to provide those huge $150 to $200 billion supplemental budgets.
And you write about this. I think it would take a lot of Americans by surprise. The Office of Management and Budget allows the Pentagon to prepare its own budget rather than going through the White House and that sort of process, as most other government agencies have to do.
It's very interesting. They do have to go through a White House process, but the relationship between the White House and the Defense Department has been very different at two critical moments in recent history. One was at the beginning of the Reagan administration, and the other was at the beginning of the Bush administration. In both cases, as I say, after 9/11, basically the floodgates were opened, and virtually anything the Defense Department asked for in its budget was something that was going to be provided by the White House, and I have to say, largely provided by the Congress as well. In this administration, largely a Republican Congress until the last 2 years, but even the Democratic Congress has not been willing to tackle the question of defense spending frontally. And the White House has really stepped aside by and large and allowed what the Defense Department wants to go through unchallenged.
This year's defense budget was about $680 billion. Without getting into major details, can you talk about what that money pays for in general, particularly the things that aren't, strictly speaking, defense, in your opinion?
Well, there's a lot of interesting expenditures in there. Of course, we maintain a military force of 1.4 million, and it's going up to about 1.6 million. So we have to pay those people. We have to provide the funds to operate and train them and maintain them, in the way that maintains their readiness, and supply them with. We have to build equipment and buy equipment to supply them with equipment. Research the next generation of equipment. Maintain a very wide basing infrastructure to maintain that force of 1.4 to 1.6 million people. In addition, we have 700,000 civil servants who work for the Department of Defense, so that something well over half of the entire federal employment is really Department of Defense employment. And then on top of all of that, we've had the expenditures of operating the forces in Iraq, 150,000 or so, and operating them in Afghanistan, which are not, of course, included in the base budget, but are usually funded in addition. They are included in the number you used, however, because that's the real overall level of our defense spending.
And you have seen definite signs that the DOD is trying to make Iraq and Afghanistan war-level spending part of its permanent baseline budget.
They are working very hard on that today. We spend roughly $170 to $200 billion a year for Iraq, Afghanistan, and some other operations in places like the Philippines. We call it the global war on terror spending, although some of it is buying basic things for the Pentagon, like equipment and restructuring military units. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff have decided very firmly that they think as much as possible of that funding should be rolled back into basic defense expenditure and not considered additional because of Iraq and Afghanistan. So while we don't know what the full number is yet, it looks right now like somewhere between $60 and $70 billion will be added to the basic budget in the next defense budget plan from the Pentagon to call it the base budget and no longer the supplemental budget for those two operations.
Gordon Adams is my guest. He's professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. He has an article in the current Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. It can be found online. It's called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda. How does U.S. defense spending compare right now, Gordon, with that of the rest of the world?
Well, overall, we have the largest defense budget in the world, and it is actually more than all of the other defense budgets in the world combined, no matter who you include, Russians, Chinese, French, British, German, Israelis, anybody. If you add them all up, the United States has the largest and now more than any other, not only more than any other, but larger than all of the defense spending plans of every other country in the world put together.
So you say that it is critical that we know that we can balance, for example, Russian and Chinese militaries. How do we know that we've done that and that it's time to stop spending?
Well, I don't know that we'll ever stop spending, but the military capability that the United States has is by and large vastly superior to any other capability in the world. We know that the Russian capability has been sadly degraded as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and just a lack of resources to spend on their own military, so that even operations that they did recently in places like Georgia continue to expose problems with equipment, problems with adequate number of troops, problems with training. The Russian army today is not the Soviet military of old. It's enough to terrify the Georgians, but probably not many other people. The Chinese, we have pretty good estimates of both what they are doing and what they intend to do. And the Chinese are building up a rather strong military capability. But it's important to keep in mind that they are decades behind the U.S. military capability today. It's relevant to U.S. deployments in the Asian theater. It is not yet a naval capability that would be the measure of the U.S. naval capability in that theater. It's kind of meaningless, I think, to compare Chinese land forces to American land forces, because I don't know anybody who thinks it would be a reasonable expectation that the United States would be engaged in a land war with China. Too big a country, too many people that can be thrown at you, almost a difficult, impossible military situation. So you have to compare militaries by looking at what you think those militaries would be designed to do. And compared to any other country in the world, the U.S. military capability is simply technologically and in training terms and capability terms vastly superior today.
On the other hand, you have, of course, the strain on the U.S. military that's been placed by the efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Setting aside Iraq for a minute, Afghanistan was the direct result of our response to a non-state actor. I mean, there are not powerful military forces in Afghanistan, and yet we have a huge amount of troops there. Maybe there's an argument for not cutting down.
We're going to have both candidates for the presidency at this point have said that they want to deal with Afghanistan. Obama has been pretty clear that he wants to do that while setting a deadline and withdrawing from Iraq. McCain has been somewhat less clear about whether he would withdraw from Iraq at the same time. We don't really have the military manpower to plus up in Afghanistan enormously without coming down in Iraq, but it's probably appropriate, in my judgment at least, to start thinking about how we do that. The strain on American military forces is real. Having said that, we've managed it pretty well. The American military capability over there is rotating frequently, but the people who are rotating through seem to like what they're doing, and they're awfully busy doing it. So it's a strain on the American military, but I think we probably shouldn't overestimate that strain by saying it's at the risk of collapse or the risk of breaking. I don't think anybody in the Pentagon seriously thinks that that force is going to break. It is just a very high tempo of operations with much shorter periods between operations, and that has a consequence for morale and a consequence for readiness that is real, and that's kind of what happens when you go to war, when you're deployed forward and operating at a high tempo.
One of the things that you would like to see happen is that we cut dollars from the defense personnel budget. And first and foremost, there are some civilian jobs, as you mentioned, in the Department of Defense. Where would you go first to find places that they could be eliminated?
Well, here's a major question that's going to face the next president. Department of Defense decided probably 18 months or so ago, with a lot of urging from a lot of people, that they needed to set a long-term goal of growing the force by nearly 100,000 additional soldiers, and mostly for the Army and the Marine Corps. That's going to cost, well, over the next 5 years, something on the order of a couple hundred billion dollars worth of additional funding. The argument for increasing the size of the military was, look at the stress of the forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, the reality is that no additional 100,000 in the uniformed land forces are going to be available in a time frame that they're going to bear any relationship to the stress on the forces in Iraq. Maybe Afghanistan, if we're going to be there for a large number of years, one doubts that even that is going to happen. But we will end up with a significantly larger personnel bill, and personnel drives everything in the military. Once you have more people, you have to do more training, you have to do more exercising, you have to do more joint exercises with other countries. You have to supply equipment to them. You have to buy that equipment. You have set in motion a broader set of forces in budget planning that say your entire defense budget is going to go up to accommodate that larger force. Now, if one thought that the United States was going to be continuously involved in a series of exercises like Iraq and Afghanistan, then you could say maybe there's a reason for doing that. But one of the lessons, I think, that people are beginning to draw from Iraq and Afghanistan is that that was probably an ill-chosen policy, especially in Iraq, where the stress has really been. So the likelihood in the near term of the United States engaging another country at the level that we're engaged in Iraq is extremely small. So we argue back and forth about, okay, well, so where would that be? Are we going to invade Nigeria? Some have talked about that. I doubt it. Are we going to invade Pakistan? Talked about that, but I doubt it. That's a country that is about six times the size of the population of Iraq, with a highly capable military and with a population that would resist very strongly any American military intrusion. Are we going to invade Iran? Unlikely in the case of Iran as well. Geographically much bigger and about five times the population of Iraq with a highly trained military. So it's hard to find a case where this is going to happen.
Gordon Adams is my guest. He's professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. His article is called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda, How to Confront the Defense Budget Morass. You can find it online right now at thebulletin.org. We'll be back to our discussion with Gordon in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gordon Adams. He's professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. He wrote a piece for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist that is out now. It's called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda. If you'd like to call, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. You would cut military personnel benefits, or at least think that the next president should consider that. What would make the most significant difference?
Well, this is, of course, the what they call the third rail of defense budget planning. It's almost politically impossible to deal with getting DOD and military benefits under control. And a lot of, you know, I can even anticipate some angry military personnel calls and even raising this topic, because anybody who raises it runs into that kind of a propeller. Having said that, over the past 15 or 20 years, we have added tens of billions of dollars to the annual defense bill by doing things like making sure that TRICARE for Life is available to all retirees. That's the military health care system. By extending various kinds of retirement benefits to those forces, by subsidizing the commissaries on bases after base so that the retired military can draw on it. And frankly, every time that one suggests that it's important to try to get benefit levels and programs under some kind of control, you have a very sharp knee-jerk reaction from the military retiree constituency, and the argument is placed squarely on the patriotic grounds. We served our country. It's time for us to draw our benefits. You know, and it's very hard to argue with that. No member of Congress is willingly going to touch that third rail and run the risk of, you know, exposing their careers. But as it has gotten very expensive, we've had to adopt all kinds of vehicles to try to make that expenditure not be an overall drag on our capabilities that we want to buy on the military side. So we take the retirement benefits, and instead of paying them out of the Defense Department budget, we only put the accrual side of those benefits in the DOD budget, and we pay out the benefits over in another part of the budget out of the Treasury Department, and we don't call it defense spending anymore. So we're shuffling pieces around, recognizing that benefits are becoming extraordinarily expensive, that the defense health care system, which is now a $30 to $40 billion a year budgetary item in defense, is, you know, incredibly expensive and subject to many of the pressures that the rest of the healthcare system is subject to. We got a real benefit backlog problem in the Department of Defense now, like we do in the country as a whole. And learning how to manage it is going to prove politically very difficult, because it's a third rail.
Well, it's a third rail issue, and you know, you mentioned that it's politically impossible. I'm wondering if you even see that there would be a will for this among American taxpayers.
Well, you know, the American taxpayer is a fickle beast. The American taxpayer wants taxes to be low, but they want to make sure they get their benefits. So an overall keep taxes down, keep government small attitude, which is common in the United States, is also matched by but not my benefits attitude. So when it's, you know, your health care system and your benefit package and your retirement package, then that's the piece that obviously shouldn't be constrained in terms of spending, and the rest of it should be constrained some other way. So, you know, individual, it's kind of like members of Congress. You know, the average reputation of the Congress with the American people is very low, under 20% approval ratings. But almost every American believes that their individual member of Congress is doing a pretty good job. So it's the same kind of problem. Taxes are too high. Government is too big. Let's get them lower. Let's get it smaller, but not my benefits.
Gordon Adams is my guest. He's professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. You can read his current essay in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist at thebulletin.org. Our number, 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Lorraine in Dallas. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. Thanks for this program. I would like to ask your guest a question about the Department of Defense and its relationship to research universities and the industrial partner. And a separate prong from that is, how does the National Nanotechnology Initiative affect the topics that are being discussed?
Boy, that's a very tough question and a very broad question combined. I'm not enough of an expert on the National Nanotechnology Initiative to really comment in any sensible way on how it relates to this. Just, you know, the obvious observation that this is a highly important and emerging area of research with a lot of funding being put into it. But it's you know, where its military applications are and how it's going to affect defense, I don't really know enough to be able to comment. The Department of Defense has been very important to research universities, and it's been very important to its industrial partners. We have a lot of change in that area because back in the old days, we could say, well, there are very big companies like Lockheed and Grumman and Northrop and Boeing and Martin Marietta that were all doing business with the Department of Defense, and you had something that we called the Defense Industrial Base, or some called it the Military Industrial Complex. The difficulty is in the American economy that more and more the technologies that the Defense Department is drawing on and using and supporting through its research dollars, and that they have a very big research budget, $70, $80, $90 billion a year, depending on the year, is going more and more into the broader economy and the broader industrial and technology base, and not so specifically to companies that are only doing business with the Department of Defense. Now, that's very good, in a sense, for the broader industrial base in the United States and the broader technology base. It also says you can't analytically now say, well, there's a military-industrial complex and then everything else in the American economy. So DoD research dollars are really important, but so are the research dollars that come from you know, the National Science Foundation and NASA and a lot of other sources of research dollars. So while defense is very important, it is only one source of research support for universities.
Of course, tied to research funding and spending is the idea that certain equipment gets updated periodically. How do you make decisions about what to keep and what to update if a new technology is available? How do we assess whether or not that's worth putting in place or whether we can make do with what we have already?
Well, in the Department of Defense, we have had for many, many years now, decades really, a next-generation technology-driven process. DoD supports some of the best research in America, and they are always leaning forward. They're always looking to the next generation, the next capability, the next technological advance. And relatively speaking, spending very little, taking current systems and upgrading them piecemeal in order to ensure you have capability but aren't spending so much in technology. The general estimate is for every additional increment of the last 10% of performance in any weapons system is probably costing 25% of the budget for research and development, because we're always pushing the edge. We've always counted for 60 or 70 years now on our technological edge over anybody else, because in population terms, we didn't have the Russian, the Soviet population, we didn't have the Chinese population, so we weren't going to have personnel in large numbers. We had to have technology in large numbers, and indeed we have had technology in large numbers. It's been very expensive. We generally push the edge of that technology, and the rule of thumb for buying that kind of technology is that most of the time, this is what I call one of the iron laws of defense buying, the system that you're going to buy probably takes twice as long and costs at least twice as much as what you projected it would cost when you started out. So we're always kind of behind the curve in budgeting for the technology that we're buying.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Harold in Greenville. Hi, Harold.
Hello. How do you do?
Fine, thank you.
I'm a retired colonel, United States Air Force, and I served in Vietnam. I was there during the Tet of 68, and I doubt if the professors had that kind of experience. But the genesis of my comments are about his wanting to dip into the benefits for retired military. Particularly in wartime, that's a very difficult political stance. And in peacetime, President Lincoln said, we shall treat the wounded and care for the widows. And that's been the mantra of the U.S. government ever since then. But as an example, if he wants to look for money, he needs to look at Medicare D. Medicare D has a prohibitive bar for competition for the medical pills bought by the pharmacological materials that are bought by the Department of Defense for anybody, for Medicare. And that was an abomination written by the drug lobbyists to provide the Medicare D bill separate from Medicare. And it's incomprehensible to me to think that the U.S. government would bar competition. As an example, the most competitive and lowest-priced drugs in the whole government establishment is the VA,
Harold,
where they put out for competition in everything they buy.
Harold, thank you very much for your comments. I think we understand exactly what you're saying. And Gordon, maybe you can talk about that. Maybe rather than cutting from the defense budget, maybe we find similar savings elsewhere.
Everybody's got their favorite recipe for where savings ought to be taken. And as I said earlier, it's usually not on my back. Thank you very much. And while benefit programs in the Department of Defense are only one example of a much larger issue that your caller is raising, they are an area where we have allowed expenses to really balloon in the last 20 years. And this is independent of party and independent of administration. The benefit levels just cannot be held down in that area. I dare say benefit levels in the Medicare-Medicaid system have been held down somewhat, but overall, there's no question that your caller is right. One of the biggest burgeoning areas of cost in the entire federal government today is the area of health care, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, benefit programs for civil servants, benefit programs for military uniforms. That's a huge issue. But the bottom line here is where the caller started. Where the caller started is, say, in a period of what's called wartime, what a politically impossible position to say we ought to be taking a careful look at benefit programs, I would say, across the entire federal government overall. You can't do that politically. It's, as I said earlier, the third rail of politics. But everybody's going to have a different, area where they want to cut the budget, and it's usually going to be an area that does not involve directly benefits that go to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Oscar in Dallas. Hello, Oscar.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I got a question for a professor.
Okay.
United States through the years have been supporting a lot of countries and another adverse governments now to the United States. And it seems to be like we should learn that we have support somebody that a few years in the future that turned against the United States. And I wonder why is the United States not learning after those experiences?
You're talking about support of Latin American regimes?
Yeah, Latin American regimes, yeah.
Okay, let's see if we can get a comment. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
This is a really great question because I think one of the challenges that the next president is going to face is looking at a different way of engaging the world than the way we have been engaging the world over the last 8 years. We've gotten to a course where now in almost every country in the world, the public opinion view and government view of the United States and its international engagement is negative. And that has had a severe impact on our leadership. The issue that he's raising is how should we be engaging the world differently? If you look at the array of issues that we are facing, whether they're issues of poverty or weak states, fragile states, or ethnic and identity conflicts like religion, or transnational challenges like terrorism, the climate change, the environment, migration, health, disease, drug trafficking, or even if you're looking at classical power conflicts with China or with Russia, all of these are challenges that the next administration is going to have to deal with, and they're not mostly amenable to military force. They share two characteristics, all the challenges that we face. Characteristic number one is, you can't really deal with them as the United States of America using just military capabilities. Trying to do that, as I would argue we have been trying to do over the last 8 years, has had severe negative consequences for our military, and it's had severe negative consequences for America's view as seen by the rest of the world. The other characteristic they have in common is the United States can't conceivably address them alone. And for the last 8 years, we've had a policy of dealing with these issues largely unilaterally, trying to deal with them with the military and solve them on our own, and they can't be solved on just by the United States alone. So the next administration is going to have to deal both with How does the whole toolkit of statecraft get balanced so we're engaging diplomatically and through our foreign assistance programs and our public diplomacy in addition to the role the military has to play, and how we're going to cooperate more fully than we have with our European allies, with Asian partners, and even with some countries that we sometimes see as adversaries to deal with some of these serious underlying international issues.
Are you confident that money cut from military budgets for traditional military applications would actually get funneled back to civilian national security efforts or to diplomatic efforts?
I think these are two separate things. It rarely happens in federal budgeting, and having had 5 years in the Office of Management and Budget where I had to do federal budgeting, you almost never have a discussion that says, okay, I'm going to cut $5 billion to defense and put it in international affairs. It's not that kind of discussion. What you have is an overall budgetary discussion, and then with respect to each of the departments or programs, what's the right level, and what can we afford in that level overall? So the question that needs to be asked on the military is not how do I whack away at the military to get money to do something else, which is the usual blunt instrument approach that people use, but what's the right level of military capability vis-a-vis all of our instruments of statecraft? And then asking ourselves, have we invested adequately in our diplomacy? Do we have enough diplomats and the right kinds of diplomats for the problems of the 21st century? How have we invested in our foreign assistance programs? Are we providing assistance of the right kind to the right countries for the right purposes? And in each of those areas, you provide the funding in your planning that you think is necessary to carry that part of our overall international engagement. So I wouldn't want it to be interpreted here that what I'm saying is slash the military so you can do something different. I'm saying balance the toolkit so we can be effective. What is the right level of military? What's the right level of international spending and diplomacy and foreign assistance?
American University Professor of U.S. Foreign Policy Gordon Adams is with us. You can read his article in the current issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists that's available online at thebulletin.org. It's called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda, How to Confront the Defense Budget Morass. We'll be back in just a moment. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gordon Adams. He's professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. You can find his essay online at thebulletin.org. It's called Establishing the Next President's National Security Agenda. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 to join the conversation or email think@kera.org. Can you talk for a minute, Gordon, about the culture of the OMB? Are the agencies that deal with it pretty siloed, or are they encouraged to understand their own budgets within a broader perspective?
I actually think, Chris, you've put your finger on what is one of the biggest challenges the next president's going to face just in terms of operating his office. Right now, virtually all of the work that the National Security Council or OMB does is stovepiped. So they're dealing agency by agency, budget by budget. There are very, very few cases where the interagency process is systematic. Now, if you think about that list of problems that I mentioned earlier, there's not one of those that any one agency can deal with alone. The State Department isn't going to be able, diplomacy alone isn't going to be able to handle the problem of terrorism. You're going to have some intel capability. You're going to have DOD capability. You're going to have some foreign assistance programs. And all of that needs to be coordinated. Right now, the White House isn't set up to do that. There is no systematic way of doing it. There are interagency working groups, but they tend not to do planning and budgeting for these types of programs. They tend more to be crisis response or policy definition. So the next president is going to have to face the challenge of saying, how do I power up the NSC, the National Security Council capability to think about real strategic planning and guidance for programs?
and how I'm going to power up my Office of Management and Budget so they think across state AID, defense, intelligence, homeland security, not to speak of commerce, HHS, and other agencies that are overseas, so that we're tackling whether it's disease vectors or terrorism or narcotics programs in a systematic and comprehensive way. How do I give guidance to the agencies so that agency A suppose it knows it's supposed to do job A and B knows it's supposed to do job B and they're supposed to work with each other? We're way, way too stovepiped, and coordination at the White House is way, way too ad hoc right now for such things to be effective. And frankly, the problems that we're dealing with in the 21st century are way too serious for us to continue to do business that way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, good afternoon. I was watching Ben Cohen, formerly of Ben and Jerry's, a year or so ago on Charlie Rose or something. And he's an activist now in, I think, reducing nuclear proliferation and such. And he quoted that we spend between $20 and $40 billion, and that was when the defense budget was $550 billion, $20 to $40 billion on storing, maintaining, and protecting obsolete nuclear weapons, weapons that can never, ever be used, you know, in any type of conflict or contemplated to be used. You know, I need to know from your perspective if that's true, and that's a huge chunk of money. And number two, a lot of pundits and a lot of conservative pundits especially say that our defense budget's in line with our GNP, that it's always 5-6% of our GNP, which is $14 trillion. Well, our GNP probably isn't going to be what it used to be, both in terms of the number and the quality. We're now a service-based economy versus a manufacturing-based economy. Is that metric still relevant?
Good questions. Very good questions. On the first one, the simple answer is yes. We probably do spend somewhere in that range of money to maintain nuclear warheads, do theoretical research because we don't actually test any weapons on next-generation nuclear weapons, to guard the weapons that we have, to make sure that the planes are capable of exercising and flying and the like. That's probably right. Now, that's $20 to $40 billion in an overall defense budget of $700 billion. So one can't say it's 10%. It's, you know, probably closer to 5% or less of the defense budget for that purpose. But, yes, we do. Now, I wouldn't say those weapons are obsolete. We don't actually know whether they're obsolete or not. But one of the policy issues that's going to face the next president is what is the direction that he wants to head us and the world on in terms of the long-term utility of nuclear weapons. We just don't talk about them anymore. They're politically obsolete, even if they're technologically important and expensive.
Well, and let me interrupt you, and I know there's more to answer, but it's interesting because unlike other kinds of weapons, unlike, you know, guns and things that you would use, even missiles, we can't possibly sell any kind of nuclear technology to another country, even if we believe that it's obsolete according to what we want it to do.
It'd be against the law to do so. And there are all kinds of international supplier agreements that prohibit the trafficking in the technologies of weapons of mass destruction. So it's not an item that has any market that is a white market. There obviously is a black market in nuclear technology because a con from Pakistan and others have been known to have been caught in the web of the black market. On the gross national product or gross domestic product issue, I've always thought that this argument about the share of defense of the gross domestic product was a red herring. It doesn't tell us very much about what's inside the defense budget. Arguably, nobody is going to agree to link defense spending to the gross domestic product, because if the gross domestic product goes down, those who would want to link it at a high proportion are suddenly going to find it's lower dollars. So it is a foolish kind of connection to say, you know, defense has or deserves some particular share of gross national product. All it really tells you is whether or not that level of defense spending is having a major impact on the gross domestic product or not. And arguably at the level that it's been for the last 15 or 20 years now, which is about 3-4.5% of gross domestic product, it's not having much of a macroeconomic impact on the American economy in general. That just says it's economically affordable. It doesn't say whether it's militarily necessary or it's driven by the right kinds of strategic considerations at all.
We have have an email that asks, why do you say defense policy has failed and as evidence use international opinion? Wouldn't a better measurement be the number of terrorist attacks on American soil over the last 8 years?
Well, that might be a fairly good index of homeland security policy, not necessarily military policy. And indeed, if you talk to Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security, he'll say precisely that. The fact that there haven't been attacks on American soil is a testimonial to the success of the Department of Homeland Security. Those who've spent a lot of time working with the Department of Homeland Security are more likely to say it's really either luck or a lack of desire to execute attacks on American soil more than it is the effectiveness of Homeland Security. But there are people who have been working hard in the Customs and Border Enforcement and Border Patrol areas and people in the intelligence community who have been doing a lot of very good work in terms of trying to track down and cut the risk of attacks on American soil. It's not really American military spending that ought to be looked at, though, in terms of the number of terrorist attacks. I wouldn't say that's a particularly good algorithm. The problem that we have, the link I was making was not that that's a failure of military policy. It is to say that by relying excessively on the military instrument as the primary instrument of our statecraft, as we have over the last 8 years, the consequence has been a decline in the American reputation internationally. Because we have shortchanged our diplomacy, because we have shortchanged our foreign assistance programs, because we have shortchanged our public diplomacy programs, and frankly, because we've had a use of the military for purposes, particularly in Iraq, that have not been seen by the rest of the world as a healthy and positive use of American military power, that's had an impact on our international reputation. So that's the link that I was making.
Presuming for the sake of this discussion that the next president, whichever man he is, goes into office with very disciplined ideas about defense spending, would that president's agenda be able to survive another terrorist attack on the country?
No, I think probably not. If you had something on the nature of a 9/11 attack on the soil of the United States of America, whatever agenda for defense spending the administration had in mind would probably go up in smoke along with whatever the consequences of the attack were. That's just in the nature of things, and it's unavoidable. The real question is going to be whether either person coming into office has a disciplined approach. I would again say not just a defense spending. We tend to get absorbed by the issues of defense spending and whether it's big or small or whether we're investing adequately in our national security. And we're using defense always as the index of that measure. And what I think I'm saying here in talking about balancing the toolkit is that our national security relies on a lot more than our military. It's just a very big piece, and we tend to be absorbed by it. But if you look at the capabilities of American diplomacy, if you look at our conflict resolution capabilities, which are thin in our diplomacy, if you look at the dispersal of programs in our foreign assistance area and the lack of a good strategic design for them, if you look at how weak and ineffective our public diplomacy programs have been over the last 10 years, then you have to say the way that the United States is engaging the world is not protecting our national security. National security is more than what we spend in the Department of Defense, but we tend not to talk about it in this broader term.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's hear next from Polizzi in Dallas. Hi, Polizzi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment that, and perhaps you and your wonderful guest can respond to this. I think sunset laws were initially set forth in order to evaluate programs and policies that have been set in place. And at the end of that particular time period, they're reviewed to see if the aim is still there, if the need is still there, if the aim is being achieved, and so on. Similarly, one of my fears is that when monies are handed out to different countries saying, you're helping us fight terrorism, here is, I believe the last figure was $7.1 billion, there isn't enough monitoring that's done in order to actually see how much of that money is being used for what. And I think some of it is almost this naive kind of trust I feel that the U.S. has in other countries. And that a political leader, when they said they would do something, they will actually follow through. And that's what one of my fears is. That, and this I know of only of a couple of countries. I don't even know where else it's happening. I would love a comment about that issue.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's just a wonderful question. And it's a wonderful question specifically with respect to the kinds of programs that the caller is calling about. There is no systematic evaluation of the success of our economic support programs or our foreign military financing programs. Now, I use those terms deliberately because those are specific and large programs in our foreign assistance budget today that go to countries with which we are developing relationships. In the case of Iraq and Afghanistan, we have developed a third category, which is called coalition support funds, where we're providing very large sums of money, $6 billion or more to Pakistan over the last 8 years, for example, to provide us with support and assistance in the war against terrorists, in the conflict with terrorist organizations. And there is no systematic evaluation of those programs either. It's one of the really weak areas of performance measurement and systematic evaluation. We don't know that we get the minimum level of cooperation that those programs require. We don't know whether we're buying capability that's really useful for us to work with another country with in combat. The evaluation side of those programs is almost nil at this point. All that says, very much what the caller is saying, that we are putting billions of dollars into supporting, providing ourselves with support from potential allied countries, but we really don't know whether the support that we're getting is adequate. In the Pakistani case, the General Accounting Office and the Congress have both begun raising questions about whether the more than $6 billion that we provided in coalition support funds alone has actually improved security in the northwest provinces of Pakistan, which is where the Taliban have escaped to, where Osama bin Laden is, and where insurgencies grow inside Pakistan itself. It would not appear, from that measurement at least, that the money has been effectively spent.
Is there any set of accountability criteria that could be universally applied to defense spending so that we're at least able to assess what's working and what's not?
There have been probably decades of efforts to do precisely that. How do you know you are getting the capability that you want to get out of this kind of spending? And actually, I have to say, relative to the evaluation of programs like the ones we were just talking about, evaluation of defense capabilities is probably better than a lot of other areas in the federal government. The ultimate test of whether you're buying the capability that you wanted to buy is whether or not it works. And that means when you deploy the forces, does the equipment work? Do the programs work? Are the soldiers properly trained? What problems are they encountering? You have a real field test in the case of military forces, and you find them wanting. And, you know, actually, that's a good thing. There are a lot of people who say, why would you criticize the military? Well, some criticism of the military is a criticism the military needs and ought to have. It's called after-action review, and it tells you whether what you bought is actually working effectively and then allows you to correct it.
Gordon Adams is professor of U.S. foreign policy at American University. You can read his work online at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists at thebulletin.org. Gordon, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.